Group Chair, Senior Fellow for Economic Policy and Director of the Center for Universal Education at the Council on Foreign Relations, the Honorable Gene Sperling.
Thank you so much. It has been just so inspiring, the reception that the first education track for the Clean Global Initiative has received. I think that when you're planning a conference, which many of you have done, you've got two sessions on Wednesday, two on Thursday, and the last one on Friday. You all know, how do you make sure you go out on a strong note? How do you make sure that you go out with inspiration and emphasis? I'd love to say that we're just great, not lucky, but we probably got a bit lucky on this. I don't think I could have predicted when we planned this panel that of our four panelists that we would have on our last panel on Friday, one, John Wood, the founder of Room to Read, would be awarded one of the certificates by President Clinton, who had read his entire book, put him in this book on giving, and really gave him as much of an embrace as you can give a social entrepreneur on stage yesterday. And that, when they would announce the first four Clinton Global Initiative Global Citizen Awards ever, the top four from all the people in the world, from all the people here, that three of them would be on our panel today. One of them is Vicki Colbert. Vicki knows that part of the reason that I have been so moved by her is not only the amazing success of Escuela Nueva, which she founded, and that Loreen and her will talk about, but that she does remind me of somebody pretty close to myself, a great educational reformer I know, my mother, though you're much younger. Vicki is that social entrepreneur that just never stops, who never stops reforming, who never stops pushing. I was so happy to see her get her recognition and due last night as one of the four winners. And one of the other four winners was Dr. Fazel Abed, who is the founder and CEO of perhaps the largest and most famous and most acclaimed NGO in the world, BRAC. And that the award, the first award for those in the general area of media and entertainment would go to Andre Agassi for the amazing work that he has done and will describe in his school in Las Vegas. Andre said to me last night when I told him how amazingly inspired I was when I saw the feature of his school on Oprah, that not a lot of men were acknowledging that they watched Oprah. So everybody there, you can come out of the closet here and admit if you saw what Andre is going to describe. And what I want to say, and I think what Andre represents on this panel, which I just think is very important for everything we're talking about, is that those of us, President Clinton, myself, in doing the Clinton Global Initiative, wanted to make people here look beyond our borders to the issues of education in developing countries. But there is nothing that would go against everything President Clinton believes in more is if anybody ever interpreted that because we want you to look beyond your own borders, that we don't want you to look in your own backyard. And to be honest, and I'll be candid, I live in Washington, D.C. I live in an apartheid city. Many of us do. We live amongst wealth and privilege, and just not 10,000 miles away, 10 blocks down the road, is exceptional poverty. And we wanted on this panel, and perhaps even more next year, to make sure that we aren't forgetting what's happening in its own, our own backyard. And that's why Andre, no one could represent that better than him. But someone who might represent it as well as him would be our moderator, Lorene Powell Jobs, because she, like Andre, has decided she didn't feel comfortable living just among wealth with poverty so close. A lot of people probably don't even know of the poverty in Palo Alto, but she started in 1997 College Track to try to get the poorest children there on the track to college, which makes her a perfect moderator for our final session. So I will turn it over to Lorene with one word from my ex, and I guess in some ways eternal boss, Bill Clinton. Whenever people were discouraged about education, how intractable the problems were, he always would say one thing. He said this in private meetings. He said this in public meetings. There is no problem, no matter how great, that somebody in the world is not solving somewhere. And so what this panel is we've brought four of the people who are solving intractable problems somewhere, and we're going to try to ask how they're doing it and why we can't be doing it everywhere. Lorene?
Thanks, Gene. Thanks, Gene. Welcome to the final education panel at CGI. Over the last 2 days, we've heard from some amazing people and organizations that reinforce our belief in the necessity of education for all children everywhere. We're all believers in the power of education to change lives. All the panelists here see it in their work every day. And given the fact that IQ and creativity are evenly distributed across the human race, it's not only the right thing, but it's in our own best interest as a global community to reach all children on the planet with a fine education. So let's be bold today and try to understand how to make that happen. Like Gene said, President Clinton has said that all problems in education have been solved somewhere by somebody. Well, we have four somebodies here, four extraordinary social entrepreneurs who have solved an education problem at the local level. And they've created a model, each of them, that with the right resources can be replicated and scaled and spread across the world. I'd like to begin with Dr. Fazl Abed. Any brief introduction of Dr. Abed is bound to be inadequate considering he runs one of the largest NGOs in the world. As you might have heard last night, BRAC operates in 69,000 villages in Bangladesh and has lifted 35 million people out of abject poverty. Central to their work is providing primary and secondary education to children, 70% of whom are girls. So, Dr. Abed, you clearly have a successful model. You focus on reaching rural children who can't access government schools. Can you please describe your model of reaching these very difficult-to-reach children?
Well, we have, we go into villages and see the children who are not going to school. By the age of 8, a child, if he or she has not been enrolled in any school, we know that the chances of them going to school is almost nil. So we take them at the age of 8 and over. So from 8 to 10, we take the children who have either never been to school or dropped out of school. So we have got two models, 8 to 10 and 11 to 14. 11 to 14 is the last chance for children who have never been to school. So these are one teacher schools. So the teacher is recruited from the village, a woman usually with 10 to 12 years of education. Then they are para teachers. They've never been to teachers before, so we give them 2 weeks of training in our training centers, a little bit of child psychology, how to do a lesson plan, and also how to make learning enjoyable. A child-centered learning approach. And we first started with 22 schools, 10 in our own project area where we do microfinance and livelihood programs, and 10 outside our project area to see whether or not our model work in both in our project area and outside. And we found 2 years later that the schools were wonderfully providing education to children. They were enjoyable, and it didn't make any difference whether it was in our project area or not. And so, therefore, we thought that the model worked. And also, we wanted to make it cost-effective in the sense that Bangladesh's per-child educational budget is $20 per child per year. So we wanted to make it cost-effective in the sense that if we spend $50 per child per year, the Bangladesh will never replicate those. So therefore, it had to be within that budget framework. So our cost is per child per year is less than $20, and the para teachers, 2 weeks of training, doesn't really make you a teacher. But then, so what we do, we have for every 15 schools, we have a supervisor, and they provide supportive supervision twice a week. So they go into school and try and see whether the teacher is doing it well. And then we provide 1 day refresher course for the teacher every month. So the teacher is upgraded continuously so that they can perform better. And we found a short training and continuous supervision and refresher course upgrade the teacher over time, and she can perform exceedingly well compared to other teachers who are better trained, long training. We find that our teachers are much more connected and perform much better. So what?
Can I ask you a quick question then? So this mentorship, does that help the teachers stay in the profession for a long time? Do you have a long retention for your teachers?
Well, I don't think our teachers drop out at all. We have not seen any of them dropping out. But that's the reason why we had one or two teachers who were unmarried and were married off to another village, so we lost her. But that's the reason why we rather have a married teacher in the village so that she doesn't go anywhere else.
Yeah, but one out of 69,000 isn't so bad.
No. No. So we now run 50,000 one-teacher schools, and we have 1.5 million children in Bangladesh. And we have got 2,000 schools going on in Afghanistan, and the same model, one teacher. The children just love this teacher. Every time a child is absent, the teacher goes to the child's home and find out why he is absent or she is absent. So we take 70% of our children are girls, because in Bangladesh it used to be that the boys get preference, and so we said that if we open a school in a village, we must get 70% girls. Otherwise, we won't even start. The chances, you know, everybody wants to send their boys to our school. And we said, no, we must have 70% girls, otherwise we won't even open this school. So then they send their girls. So it's a kind of a incentive to send girls to school. And we provide all educational materials, the books, the slates, the pencils, exercise books and everything. So there's nothing to pay. And also the other thing, most of our children, their parents are illiterate, so they can't do the homework. They can't get any support from parents for homework. And they're too poor to get private tuition. So therefore, all the teaching learning has to be done in the school itself. And the homework given is something that they can do themselves without any support from parents. So minimal homework, all the teaching learning taking place in school itself, and therefore the children stay. And they love it. And we have absenteeism of less than 5%.
Thank you. One quick question about your model. What kind of results or outcomes are you seeing as far as children continuing from primary school to secondary school?
Well, we thought that the poor children coming from very poor families would be quite satisfied receiving primary education of 5 years. But then we were quite surprised to find that 94% of them want to go to high school. So they transition on to high school. And then, of course, the system in general, high school in Bangladesh is not that responsive to the needs of the poor, and the class sizes are large, the teaching, learning is not very good. So many of them drop out, but then they do enter secondary schools. But we find that many of our children, it's only 17% actually complete high school. So that's a problem that we face now. So I'm now trying to help the high schools to improve quality of teaching learning. So that's my second group, agenda, to try and improve high school education.
Thank you. I remember one story Dr. Abed told about children swimming to school during a flood. And it made me think of children in the United States who are praying for snow days on the East Coast. A bit of difference. Our next panelist, moving to the problems in the U.S., our next panelist is Andre Agassi, who in 2001 founded the Agassi College Prep Academy. The middle school was recently commended as an exemplary school under the No Child Left Behind Act. His school is a charter school, K-12, and for those of you outside of the country, a charter school is a public school, but it has more flexibility around curriculum, teacher training, teacher pay, school day hours, and other funding mechanisms. So, Andre, can you please talk to us and describe how your school is different from other public schools in Las Vegas?
Yeah, thanks, Lynn. What we wanted to sort of show is not just to sort of bring a great standard of education to 650 kids, K-12, 50 in each grade. We wanted to sort of blow up a paradigm. We want to say, what if we take a great school, put it in an area of the city that is economically challenged, and bring some of the best teachers there? What would happen to these children that society sort of writes off the most? And, we wanted to also show that when you give, if you can just get the resources and be accountable with those resources, what you'd actually be capable of. So how we're accountable with our Nevada funds at $5,200 per student per year. We're 49th in the United States per pupil allocation. The national average is closer to $9,000. So we subsidize that difference as a foundation and give this education for the national average. We were the only school sort of deemed exemplary, recognized sort of for our work, but we do that by creating a culture. I mean, we have parents that sign contracts, which is a crucial part of a children's nurturing and learning environment. They have to sign off on every homework assignment. They have to give volunteer time to the school. They have to read to their children 30 minutes a night. We have children that have to sign contracts. You'll never get kicked out for your grades, but you will get kicked out for behavior, or for being disruptive or interrupting others' education. Teachers sign contracts. They have to be reachable 24 hours a day by the students if need be. We have no teacher tenure. You can be fired if you're not living up to the standard. We pay on a bonus structure as well, which we feel has motivated a partnership with these teachers. We find that they are inspired to do more work if they feel like they have ownership in these children's lives. And through this process, we've created a culture that proves that at the national average, you can actually educate children at a high standard.
Terrific. And as far as parental involvement goes, since you're working in some low-income and immigrant communities, I'm sure that there's some families for whom English is not the language spoken at home. So how do you involve the parents? Do you do any sort of parental training? Do you involve other resources in the community to support the students?
In our particular area where we built the school is about 96% of our students are African-American, 2% Hispanic, and maybe 1% Caucasian. 70% of them come from one-parent homes. We have computers in our school. When we built the school in this area, we were told, there's going to be crimes committed. Your name's going to be on this thing. This area has so much crime. And we believe something different. We believe if you give this community something to take ownership of, something that they could call their own, that they'll respect it and nurture it. And since we opened the school, we've never had any sort of graffiti. Not even one sort of part of our school has been vandalized on any level. But these parents are not just allowed to come to school, they're actually, you know, it's actually demanded of them. We have participation where we make sure they come and get involved with volunteer work. We have a computer room that hosts many computers that just the children aren't get to access it. The parents actually can come use these computers. You know, there has been, we have found that if you find ways to motivate the parents to feel like this is a good thing in their lives, it helps them understand what environment their children are living in. For example, and our nurse that we have for our school has reached out through the children Sunrise Children Foundation. She'll have once every few times a year a mammogram on wheels show up at the school, and the kids' mothers can actually come to the school and get checked for breast cancer.
That's terrific.
We'll have lens crafters show up in the back, and these parents will leave that day with a pair of glasses, as well as other kids in the community and in the local schools around. This is about reaching out and creating dynamics that we're stronger when we're together, and that's what we're hoping we're doing.
It sounds like it's much more than a school. It's a real community center.
It's a way of life.
Yeah. Thank you. Our next panelist, Vicki Colbert, created the Escuela Nueva curriculum 30 years ago to reach the most vulnerable children in Colombia. She changed the way children are taught because she understood how children learn. She built upon her grassroots movement to develop a national policy and then an international program serving 5 million children in 14 countries. So, Vicki, can you please describe for us the innovative Escuela Nueva curriculum?
Yes. First of all, I have to describe the problems we met in Colombia, which are very similar in the rest of the Latin American region, when I started working with some wonderful Colombian teachers. Low teacher morale. It's like a failing company, you know, a company with no results. Low performance. Weak school-community relationships. High repetition rates. Tremendous dropouts. No learning takes place. Parents do not participate in the learning process with their children. Highly ineffective teacher training strategies. No learning materials in the schools. Less than 1% of the budgets go into learning materials. So it's like a failed company. So what did Escuela Nueva try to do? We built on what already existed in the country, the unitary school movement promoted by UNESCO in the 60s that worked with multi-grade schools. 60% were multi-grade schools. These schools are invisible to educational planners. And without tackling these schools, millennium goals will not be reached. So we started tackling all these issues in a systemic way, not tackling each in isolation. So Escuela Nueva has four major components: curriculum, teacher training, community, and local management. Because we learned that if we want to make changes in children, we also had to make changes the way teachers were trained, the way the schools related to the community. So we had to address this in a systemic way, four related components in synergy, and in a cost-effective way. We always had to think, how can this be scalable? So what does it promote? Active participatory learning, which is not new in philosophy. This was said 100 years ago. Collaborative learning, children learn through dialogue and interaction. That, you know, that's right now the cutting edge. Self-paced learning, self-directed learning. That was one of the reasons schools expelled children instead of attracting them. Did not adapt to their situations. Self-paced, self-directed learning. A new role for the teacher as a facilitator and a catalyst. Instead of spending too much time giving instruction, the teacher could spend more time helping comprehension, which, by the way, is the problem in Latin America. 60% do not understand what they read. This is a big problem. How can you have a competitive country when people do not understand what they read? A good, strong school-community relationship. We had to look for the ways parents could participate in the learning process. So this is what Escuela Nueva promotes. But it's something, we have something key. A new generation of self-paced, self-directed learning, interactive textbooks. When I talk about interactive, I'm not talking right now about new technologies. You know, there were no learning materials. So in a good private school, you have a textbook, a workbook, the guide for the teacher, and we had to design learning textbooks that were 3-in-1. Textbook, workbook, and the guide for the teacher, a planning tool. Teachers do not have time for planning, unless for 6 grades simultaneously or 5 grades in many countries. Nobody can do it. So here we had to design these types of learning materials that are reusable. They can remain in a school for at least 10 years. And this is very important because we had to think of something that was cost effective. We weren't looking for selling books. So we had to design all these inputs in all these ways. This was in the rural areas, and it was just, we'll talk about the outcomes afterwards. But we also adapted it to urban schools. And now to internally displaced children, which are migrant, and they are excluded from the conventional. The conventional school expels children, does not attract children. They will not remain in these schools because they need more personalized and also cooperative learning, peer tutoring, and all these things. So we also have adapted it for internally displaced children for migrant population, and now we're tackling secondary education.
And because you were very mindful of costs, what did it end up costing per student?
Well, if you do an investment for 10 years, and I'm not very good in costs, our inputs are in teacher training, very practical, hands-on teacher training. You know, teachers have to be trained with the same methodologies children work with. You know, not in Latin America, we have wonderful conferences on active participatory learning. So we had to change all these things. Teacher training, very practical, hands-on, and the learning materials for children, which are reusable. So over a 10-year period, our costs are $8 per year per child because we had to look for something that was really cost-effective so countries could pick it up.
Right. Thank you. Next to Vicky is John Wood, the founder and CEO of Room to Read. By the end of this year, Room to Read will have built 5,000 reading rooms in developing countries. We heard a bit about Room to Read at the plenary, but John, can you please talk to us about your model of building schools and libraries in developing countries and how your educational outreach works?
Yeah, thank you. Room to Read is about 7.5 years old, so we're still relatively young. We're working across 8 countries in Asia and sub-Saharan Africa with 3 major programs, school construction, we call it school room, reading room, which establishes bilingual libraries, and Room to Grow, which gives long-term scholarships to girls who are often left out of the system. For the school construction program, I think the first thing we really want to do is make sure that we are setting ourselves up for success by involving the community from a very, very early stage. We actually don't want to invest in a community until the community is really rallied around the idea of building their school. We call it the Challenge Grant. We challenge the community by saying, you need to get the land donated. You need to get the parents to donate labor. You need to see if you can get small amounts of money, stipends, micro contributions from the village residents. And you have to go as a village and lobby your local or national Ministry of Education to assure that teachers will show up. You can only help people if they want to help themselves. And so what we are trying to do is rather than coming in as well-meaning Westerners and plunking down a school and hoping it works, what we're saying is if the village proves that it wants a school, we will then match them with a Western donor who can then help to finance the construction of that school. Just a couple quick examples. I've watched mothers in Nepal waking up before sunrise and walking 2 hours down a mountainside on a donkey path to put 110-pound bags of cement on their backs and walk back up the hill. This is before the mothers have to go out to the farm and work the fields for the day. I have sat at school opening ceremonies as they read the names of all 183 families who have each given the equivalent of $5 to help pay for the bricks and mortar. That's a lot of money to these families. So what we are really trying to do is set ourselves up for success by getting the community involved very early on. And as all of us know from our travels in the developing world, people are not afraid of hard work. There's a strong work ethic. Parents are the same everywhere. They want their children to have a better future. And that usually comes down to education. So in addition to that, the Challenge Grant acts as an anti-corruption device because people don't steal from themselves. Right? If you go to a developing world village and you throw $30,000 on the table and say, here, good luck, build something, that money quite often will disappear. When you have parents putting in land, labor, and small amounts of money, that really definitely helps a lot. Donors love the model because they know that for $15,000 total, a school in Nepal has been built serving a couple hundred children. For $18,000, a preschool has been built in Vietnam, which is not only important for the little children, because about a huge percentage of brain development happens before the age of 6, but also preschools free up the eldest daughter in the family to attend primary or secondary school because she's no longer having to babysit during the day. So that's very, very important. And then we add on, and we talked on the day one about toilets. We add on boys and girls toilets with running water and put in a library to the school.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, I think we have a good sense of the four different models here. So I want to talk about scale while we all have a chance before we run out of time. So, Vicki, the impact and effectiveness of your program has been widely evaluated and documented. You've replicated your model successfully, mainly through leveraging partnerships with governments. So what are your greatest challenges to the organization as you continue to scale?
Well, first of all, Escuela Nueva became a national policy in Colombia. It's a public policy. And this is happening also in other Latin American countries. It has become a policy. And this is the strength, but it's also one of the problems, because governments change, and I have mainly, this has spread out mainly through governments, and this is very, very important to learn to work with the governments. But then we, to sustain the innovation, once we knew it had results, we had to create an NGO to continue working with the governments, Escuela Nueva Foundation, now in Colombia, now we have our sister organization here in the States, to continue insisting, working with the governments to make sure it's sustained. It's not only to introduce the innovation, but how to sustain the innovation. So at this moment, it has spread out through many countries. We're a small NGO. So a big challenge for our institution is we need partners, business partners, to help us franchise, to help us see the best way of smart scaling. Many countries came into Colombia once the World Bank selected it in 1989 as one of the three major innovations of the developing world. Many countries started coming in, and not only from Latin America, but from Asia and Africa. So we said, take it, copy it, do this. But then we learned that we have to control quality.
Right.
And so at this moment, we need to learn to smart scale. Our scholar award this year was precisely to help us smart scaling to ensure that we can control. We want to be the hub of the Escuelas Nuevas. We want to have a community of practice of all the Escuelas Nuevas in the Latin America and the Caribbean region, hopefully in the future also in, it's already in the Philippines. And we want to do smart scaling, a good learning network, but we need business partners. We need pro bono to help us think of how to do it.
Thank you. Just a clarifying question. So are you building out the Escuela Nueva Foundation so that you can control the implementation of Escuela Nueva and then you can continue to monitor it as they implement it?
Exactly. So we can be a resource center and to help promote the quality and the sustainability, because necessarily it loses quality only in the hands of the government.
Do you have corporate partners now?
We're looking for corporate partners.
Okay. Dr. Abed, you've replicated your model in Afghanistan in 2002. What are your greatest challenges there, and what do you see as the challenges as you expand through Africa?
Mainly money. Afghan children, there are lots of children out of school. So we need to expand the program in a significant way. In order to expand, you need to first test the model that it works well, and then you have to be efficiently expanding it. And then you need resources, you need training centers for teachers, you need infrastructure, logistics, so you need all of that, and you need to develop your model throughout the country. So we are working in 24 provinces out of 32 in Afghanistan, and there are some provinces we are not working yet. So we'd like to work in those. We have got only $12 million out of donors for Afghanistan's PRAC program for primary education for girls. We would like 120 to do it for the entire girl population who are out of school in Afghanistan. We would like to, we are expanding our program into Africa. We have started 200 schools in the north of Uganda. We would like to have a couple of thousand schools in southern Sudan. we have so the resources are a constraint. But then in some societies, even if you have resources, you don't have the infrastructure. In other words, schools need to be built. You really can't get a place where to set up a school. In Bangladesh, we find we don't have to build schools. Somebody will give you a room with 300 square feet of space, and then we can start a school. So building is not necessary. We would really like to set up school as fast as possible while the girls are still young enough to go to school, because if you're slow, we are not in a hurry, we just lose them. So we just would like to have funding and some infrastructure, minimal infrastructure, to start schools and provide them good education. So that's what we are after.
Thanks. John, your organization seems particularly adept at replication. You've grown very quickly. Have you had time to evaluate your impact? Is evaluation a challenge for your organization? Is this something that will be key to your growth? And what are some of your other constraints to growth?
Well, I definitely think monitoring and evaluation is always a challenge for anything, but especially in the developing world, there usually are not government statistics that are being collected that a small NGO that's in its early days can piggyback on top of. So that's definitely one of the challenges. So we're looking at what things can we measure in the early years as we're first getting started, because anybody who says that they operate for 3 years and that they've increased literacy by X percent, you really have to rely quite often on the governments to be collecting that data. What we're looking at are the success metrics we can look at in the short term are what percent of our scholarship girls passed from one grade to the next. You're taking girls from very poor families, quite often orphans. Last year, 98.5% of our girls passed on to the next grade. We're looking at, we self-publish local language children's books using local authors and local artists. And we've done about 250 of these. AED this year gave it one of the Breakthrough Innovation and Education Awards. We actually go out and we survey our customers. We actually go out and we talk to the students and ask them, do you like the stories? Do you like the pictures? 97% and 98% last year said yes to those questions. And quite often we learn a lot by going out and talking to the families, talking to the students and talking to the teachers to find out what we can do better. One of the first things we found in doing our first monitoring in our Nepali libraries, which is our biggest country for libraries, we're establishing this year about 1,600 libraries, about four per day. One of the things we discovered early on, though, is the lack of relevant content for children. If you're a parent in Nepal, a book is a luxury item. If you're a parent in Cambodia, guess what? The Khmer Rouge burned all the books. So we've had, with a grant from the Skoll Foundation, to start actually finding the local authors and the local artists. We've done 250 original titles to date, and we're talking about scale. Our hope is to eventually be doing over 1,000 original titles per year, all local artists and local authors doing original content. These are not translations.
Where do you publish these books?
We publish them locally. We actually do story writing competitions, and actually some of our books have been written and illustrated by students. Uh-huh. I'll just give you one very quick story. A girl in Sri Lanka wrote a book called Baby Fish Goes to School, and it was all about a little fish that didn't go to school because the school was on land. And so it's a book about inclusion, and this fish was really sad, and it cried every morning to its mother saying, why can't I go to school? And the mother said, well, life's not fair. And then all the other animals went, and they bought a fish bowl, and they came and they scooped up baby fish. And they took baby fish to school in a big parade, and they plunked the fishbowl down next to the chalkboard. So we're actually going to, you know, those are exciting to see the children actually writing and realizing. And for a little 10-year-old girl in Sri Lanka whose parents didn't even go to school, to now be in school on a scholarship and to be a published author, that's empowering.
That's a good resume. Andre, you'll be fully enrolled K-12 by this time next year. What are your biggest lessons learned from this trajectory? And will you take this learning and share it with other charter schools? Do you intend to scale it at all?
Well, the biggest lesson learned is that it's impossible to reach a child early enough in life. I mean, you know, we started in third grade and started adding a grade and quickly realized, you know, we got to go into urgency DEFCON 4 mode and get to kindergarten. I mean, in Nevada, we don't even have full-day kindergartens in public schools. We have 8-hour kindergartens. That's when the brain develops. The earlier you can reach a child, the better it is. But while we're 49th in per-pupil allocation and funding, we're 50th and putting kids into college in our state. So it's no wonder we're getting sort of what we're asking for. So what we want to do is prove success, and the success is one thing to say. In the fifth largest school district, we're the only school deemed exemplary and nationally recognized for it, but that's not the success we're looking for. We're looking for these children's lives to be successful. Once these children's lives are successful, we want to have a conversation with the state. We want to figure out how we can raise the national, raise our state to the national average, and find a way to be accountable with those funds through educating people on what we're doing, so that we can actually, you know, connect the dots between our charter school, private funded, part state funded, and connect that to the full public schools, which is all public. I mean, President Clinton came to our school to tell you a quick little story, and he was absolutely blown away with it. We were walking around, and he actually ended up teaching a class for 30 minutes, you know, despite what the Secret Service wanted him to do. But and it was amazing to sort of listen and talk to these kids. But he was just so blown away and taken by it. He started to participate, and he, you know, literally with tears in his eyes as we walked around the whole day taking information in, asking all these questions, positive questions. And as he's leaving, he's a few paces ahead of me, and he turns around and he starts walking back up the aisle, like, and he had this disturbed look on his face, and he gets up to me and he says, "You got one problem with the school. It's just occurred to me. You have one problem that you have to fix." And I was like, "Please, you know, tell me, what's this problem?" He goes, "Why aren't people breaking down these doors or breaking into these doors to figure out how they can do it? That's the problem you have to solve. You solve that problem and really some amazing things are happening." So, you know, needless to say, that advice was everything we were striving for when we started school. We're pushing forward on that. We'd love any other ideas, by the way. And, you know, but resources is obviously a key component to all of it. But at the end of the day, we can show something that others can do.
Right. It's also the ethos of the place. Well, if you can, through your charter school, affect the public school system, that would be quite a feat. Everybody else would like to learn from that. Gina, is our time up here?
Yes, and we gave you extra time, too, because we wanted to, because thank this you. Was so terrific. Just a couple things real quickly. This is the last session, so I won't do it all at once. I just got to do a couple of thank yous first, and right now, two people in the back of the room there, Dana Rosenberg, Ed Hughes. If you knew the hours these two have put in to make the entire Clinton Global Initiative happen. And they gave me money for two deputies, and I said, "Can I divide it and get three?" And they said, "That's okay." I needed six, but I had three who did the work of six. One of them there is Brian Deese. Brian is supposed to be a third-year Yale Law student. And then Michelle Jolin, who's been my partner going back to the White House. But we'd all admit that the person who did the most work over the last several months was our deputy, Justin Van Fleet. Unfortunately, we made him work too much. He went into the hospital on Friday, and when the night before we left, I would have thought there was somewhere between a 1% to 3% chance that he would make it here. He was so heartbroken, and we sent him down a stretch limo on Thursday, and his mother, who's a nurse, as all mothers are, but she's actually a nurse, and Justin have made it up, and I'm so, so happy that you're here for at least one of our sessions after all the work you did, Justin. All right, we're going to ask a slightly different question this time. Normally, we've been using kind of the standard question, name three most important things and the people who do them. We want to go with the flow of this. This is about scaling success, so we want to ask, and there's a lot of people who are dealing with this with their own organizations, what are the keys to scaling and spreading these kind of successful proposals? And, you know, this is something where whether you're in business and you're franchising with quality or an NGO, this is something lots of people can bring to the table here. So we would really like you to think very hard about this. But one last thing. With about 5 or 7 minutes to go, we'll say when there's 5 minutes to go, we'd like you just to spend your last 5 minutes just listing what you would like to see in the education track next time. It doesn't have to be completely new. It could be something we mentioned that you want more emphasized. But I can't have all this, these people in the room and not get your advice as to what we missed, what we didn't emphasize enough, what we could do more of next year. Well, see, I'm assuming we're doing education next year. We'll look forward to having our panelists for another 20 minutes to answer some of your questions when you're done. Thank you.